Kicking off the ILS season, Stuart Horn with you. ILS speaker tonight is Tom Brokaw, just a couple of minutes away, broadcasting worldwide on radio.dominican.edu.
I know. I know. We're waiting. Mr. Brokaw is here. He's going to be here any second. So I've just been texted to tell you that he is here. And I would like to give you some updates about what is coming up so we can save some time. My name is Denise Lucy. I'm the professor of leadership here at Dominican and the director of our Leadership Institute and the co-sponsor of this lecture series with Book Passage. And in the foyer, we had some brochures that showed the programming that we have coming up the rest of this semester. I hope you will actually gather those when you leave tonight, if you haven't gotten one yet. But we're really excited that you're here this evening, especially on this amazing night. Go Niners, right? Go Niners! Don't tell us the score. Those of us who've been working tonight, we don't know the score. We don't want to know the score. Please don't tell us. Okay. So, on February 9th, we have a wonderful program coming, and it's Dr. Robert Bella. And Robert Bella is an expert in religion and human evolution. And our freshman students, as part of their freshman experience program, will be attending that event, and we welcome all of you to join us. It's a free lecture and open to the public, and Dr. Bella is quite renowned in his field, February 9th. Eve Ensler, in conversation with Isabel Allende. Who knows who Eve Ensler is? Who is she? Vagina Monologues, the author of the one-woman show Vagina Monologues, and she has taken that show all over the world and has raised $80 million to fight against violence against women. And she will be here, and Isabel Allende will be interviewing her. And what's so fun about this is that a week in advance of that, our students, just coincidentally, are actually going to be performing Vagina Monologues here in this auditorium, so we'd just love to have you come to both of those. That's on February 24th, and the student play is on the 17th of February. Jennifer Granholm, she is the former governor of Michigan. She will be here on March 25th and in conversation with Dan Mulhern, and her story is a governor's story, the fight for jobs and America's economic future. Annie Lamott is coming on April 11th, and her story is Some Assembly Required, A Journey of My Son's First Son. Then the One Book, One Marin is a wonderful gathering of the Marin County Libraries, Book Passage in Dominican, and we host the annual culminating event for the One Book, One Marin Prize. This year, Michael David Lucas has won that award for the book called The Oracle of Stamboul. And it's always a wonderful evening, and he will be interviewed by Michael Krasny. All of these events are free except for Eve Ensler, which is a fundraiser. It's a $35 fee, and it also comes with a copy of her book, and you can buy those tickets at Book Passage. So we're thrilled that you were here this evening, and I would expect any minute we will have Mr. Brokaw on stage. So just give us another couple minutes. Thank you. I'd like to introduce to you Elaine Petricelli, the owner of Book Passage, and Bill is here this evening as well. Thank you, Bill and Elaine, for being our wonderful co-hosts for the lecture series. And Elaine will be introducing our Private Ocean, the CEO for Private Ocean, who is our lecture host for this semester. And also, this evening's lecture is sponsored by Circle Bank. Kim Cassielonis is here, the CEO. Thank you, Kim, for all your support. There you are, Kim. And we can't thank you enough for helping us make this a reality. Both Private Ocean and Circle Bank are hugely important to our community, and we can't thank them enough for reaching out and inviting us to be their partners. So thank you again. Elaine Petricelli.
Good evening. I'm so excited to see you all here on the first of our spring 2012, it is spring, isn't it, lecture series. And I do thank Circle Bank for this evening, and especially Richard Stone. Richard Stone is a trustee of Dominican University. He is the co-founder of Private Ocean, the private wealth management firm. Worth Magazine has declared that this firm is in the top 100 wealth management firms over 7 times. So I think they're not exactly new here. He was recently awarded the Impact Leadership Award for a lifetime of continual financial management services by Charles Schwab. And we are really very proud that Richard Stone has decided to support the community and this lecture series. He is a truly important and wonderful citizen. Richard.
Thank you very much for braving the weather this evening and also keeping hush about the game, so we won't say anything about what's happening. The last time Mr. Brokaw visited Dominican, it was in October of 2010, when he served as the moderator of California governor's debate between candidates Jerry Brown and Meg Whitman. This very stage that I'm standing on tonight was transformed by our friends at NBC Bay Area into Debate Central. Mr. Brokaw has reported in more than 30 documentaries on a variety of topics. He has received numerous honors and has an impressive series of firsts, including an exclusive U.S. one-on-one interview with Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev. He was the first and only anchor to report from the scene the night the Berlin Wall fell, and he was the first American anchor to travel to Tibet to report on human rights abuses and to conduct an interview with the Dalai Lama. He is known for his best-selling landmark work in American journalism and for the New York Times bestsellers, The Greatest Generation and Boom, Voices of the 60s. This evening, Mr. Brokaw will talk with us about the challenges that face America in the new millennium. In his new book, The Time of Our Lives, he engages us in an important conversation about America, who we are, where we have been, and where we need to go in order to recapture the American dream. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tom Brokaw.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Thank you all very much for turning out. Let me just, if I can, make one suggestion at the very beginning. Tomorrow, when people ask you, did you see the end of the Giants 49ers game? Say to them, God, I did, wasn't it great? Don't tell them you were watching me, because that would be a terrible commentary on priorities. They're in overtime, game is tied 17-17. So that's where we are. It's gonna be a race to the death for one team or the other. I'm very happy to be back here on this stage. I happen to pick evenings to come to Dominican College when the attention is focused elsewhere. Some of you may not remember this, but the night of the last Meg Whitman-Jerry Brown debate was the night that the Chilean miners were being extracted from that deep mine in Chile. That was playing out on all the other television channels, but we know that the civic-minded people of California were only watching Meg Whitman and Jerry Brown that night. I am very flattered that you're here, obviously. I'm an assimilated California earlier in my career, and then I still claim a kind of citizenship. I care a lot about this state. First of all, I left a lot of tuition at Stanford, less at Berkeley, but nonetheless, I have an enormous attachment to California. My mother, in the early 1980s, my parents grew up in South Dakota, and when they were getting to a certain stage in life, we were able to buy them a retirement home in Southern California. And they moved there, and unfortunately my father had a massive cardiac attack 18 months later, and we lost him. And my mother went back to South Dakota and sold everything that she didn't need and said, I'm moving to California. South Dakota doesn't need one more widow. Came to Southern California and lived for the next 30 years of her life until we lost her last fall. But it was, for her, the life that she really deserved in so many ways. I said she had the best of two worlds. She had a South Dakota upbringing and a California lifestyle. So we have any number of attachments to the state. And I spent Friday with Governor Brown in Sacramento talking about the challenges that are before you. I came to California as a 26-year-old network correspondent. It was a huge development in my life and in my career, and of course it set the stage for what I was able to do after that. And I came at a particularly fortuitous time in terms of political developments in the world, that in the world, and especially in the world of California politics, this state was changing enormously. Pat Brown was at the end of his second term, and there was an actor in Hollywood that the Democrats didn't take seriously enough by the name of Ronald Reagan, who decided to run for the Republican nomination, and one of my first assignments was to spend time with him. And then Jerry Brown, who was just out of the seminary, was hanging around his father's campaign, and we got to be friends because we were part of a small circle of young people, Democrats and Republicans and journalists, who on Saturday nights would get together for cheap wine and spaghetti dinners and talk about the world and where California may be going. So it was such a rich environment for me. I have two lingering memories about that experience. One is that because Ronald Reagan was so unknown as a political force when he began, people have a hard time remembering that, and I was on the bus and getting to know his political operatives, and then covered him during two terms as governor, and then when he decided to run for the presidency, I was working in the East by then, and I would say to my political friends, he's coming and he's a force. He's the master campaigner of his time. He has caught the rhythms of the expectations of this country in many ways. You cannot write him off as just a California actor. And of course, he was elected to two terms as president of the United States. And so I asked for the final interview with him. And on the Friday before the president and Mrs. Reagan packed up and left the White House, I was granted that interview. I went down, and in those days, things were very carefully arranged, especially at the end of his second term. And I was the only subject on his schedule that day, that Friday. I went in and read it, and it said, president schedule for the day, January 17th. Interview with Tom Brokaw, that was it. The interview would begin at 11:30. I was told by his staff, camera crew should arrive at 10. Mr. Brokaw can arrive at 11:15 to get in place. The President of the United States will enter the Oval Office at 11:28. He'll sit down at 11:30, do the interview for 30 minutes, and then at 12:01, he'll thank the crew. He'll pose for pictures with them briefly, and then he would like to take Mr. Brokaw out onto the portico overlooking the Rose Garden. This is his idea. We don't know quite what to expect. It all went off like clockwork. It was a very well-run White House. The president comes through the door of the Oval Office every inch, the President of the United States. Ronald Reagan sits down. I was doing a long documentary about the rise of Ronald Reagan, how he came to be who he was, beginning with his childhood. Later won a number of journalistic prizes, and he was very forthcoming and quite winning in that interview. And at 30 minutes in, I said, thank you, Mr. President. He said, thank you, Tom. He turned and thanked the crew, and he said, Tom, why don't we go out on the portico overlooking the Rose Garden? I said, Mr. President, what a good idea. This had all been... Man, so we walked out, and I could see that the staff was still very puzzled by all of this. I didn't know what to expect, so we went out, because the president was very reserved, personally. A lot of people didn't realize that. He didn't engage in small talk. We went out of the portico, and suddenly a photographer appeared. And the president said, you know, Tom, Nancy and I were talking this morning at breakfast. You were there at the very beginning. And I said, yes, Mr. President, I was, and it's been a privilege to be able to cover your campaigns, both for governor and for President of the United States, even though we didn't always see eye to eye, and I know you weren't always happy, you were always fair with me. And he said, well, we always appreciated your coverage. And he looked around, he put his arm around me, and he said, it worked out pretty well for both of us, didn't it? And I said, yes, Mr. President, it did. The other story involves my friend Jerry Brown, and we were friends when he was a young man, and he was obviously interested in politics from the very beginning, but he was a practicing lawyer in Los Angeles, and we laughed about this the other day. One night in 1968, His father has been defeated in 1966. Jerry is thinking about his own political career at that point, but we would do these Saturday night dinners, a group of us in Southern California, all in our 20s, all interested in public policy and what was going on in the arena in California and beyond. And we were at a friend's house, and I said, kind of thinking out loud, gosh, Meredith and I are going to go to Europe next week on our first ever European trip. That's how much life has changed. I have six-year-old granddaughters who've been to Italy 3 times by now. And I said, you know, we have 2 children, and I don't think anything will happen to us, but if it did, we've not made any arrangements. We don't have that much to leave. And Jerry said kind of quietly, well, that's pretty routine. Let me just take care of it on Monday. I'll write up a little will and send it over. And I said, well, that'd be great, thank you. And so Monday morning, we were leaving on Tuesday, this will arrived from Tuttle and Taylor. I grabbed it and put it in the file, and we took off for Paris and London and Rome, where I was working and vacationing as well, and didn't think anything more about it. Until, of course, Jerry got elected governor of California twice, and then he was running for president. And there was a time, briefly, when people were talking about the possibility of him getting the nomination, and there was even some discussion he may become president of the United States. And I said to Meredith, my God, Jerry Brown wrote our first will. Think about that. We ought to go take a look at that. So I went and got it out of the file and read it and realized for the first time that when we die, all of our belongings will go to a yoga colony in Santa Monica. Or to, it turns out, a high-speed training going from Northern California to Southern California. I've gotten a fair amount of mileage out of that story, which is completely contrived, and Jerry knows it by now. So I use those examples of all the changes that have occurred in California. In the time that, from the time I first arrived here in 1966, there were 20 million people, there are 35 million plus now. The state has this enormous budget deficit. The richest state in America have the equivalent of an economy the size of the 8th largest nation in the world, more Nobel laureates than any other country, great university system. But a struggle is underway in California to right yourself, as I don't need to tell you that. At the same time, California, which has always been on the leading edge of where America is going, now finds itself kind of emblematic of how America got in trouble. A lot of stuff got leveraged here, a lot of debt got accumulated. There were some pension programs that were put together and other fiscal matters that people didn't pay enough attention to in the public arena. And the private side, in Southern California especially, there were these enormous developments and the housing market was churned. And so there's a world of trouble in California, even with all of your potential. And that's reflective of what's going on in the country, quite honestly. Now, having said that, I think it's a rare opportunity for this country, where we are at the moment. It's a rare opportunity because the great test of any nation and its people at any time is how they rise to the occasion, how they meet those challenges. You know that I wrote a book called The Greatest Generation about that generation that came of age in the deprivation and the common sacrifice of the 1930s. When every day was about what you could earn and what you could share with others. And just when they were beginning to emerge from that, they were asked to go thousands of miles across the Pacific and thousands of miles across the Atlantic and make extraordinary sacrifices trying to win the greatest war in the history of mankind. Before it was over 50 million people had perished and it encompassed most of the globe. And at home, people made enormous sacrifices. But they were able to do that and win and come back and then build the nation that we have today, again by invoking the values that they learned first in the Depression and then in the war by working together and by saving and having the value of thrift and the value of proportion. We seem to have lost our way in many instances in that regard. And so that prompted me to think about my own life and how I was raised and what I have seen. And this book, The Time of Our Lives, is a product of that reflection. It really began in the spring of 2009 when I was in Normandy for the 65th anniversary of the D-Day invasion and then went to Germany, to Dresden, to interview the new president of the United States, first African-American president. And there I was in Dresden, which had been called the Florence of Germany, the Florence of Europe, before the war began, and then it was bombed within an inch of its life during the closing days of World War II, and then lived 40 years behind communist lines. But it was being rebuilt. You could sense the possibilities of Dresden again. The president was going from there to Dachau, one of the most notorious of the death camps, with Angela Merkel, a woman who was the chancellor of modern Germany, who on the day the Berlin Wall fell, walked across from the eastern sector into the western sector because she was living on the other side of the wall as a laboratory technician. Now she's presiding over a unified Germany. And the president would be going from there after his visit to Dachau with Elie Wiesel to Normandy, the 65th anniversary of that invasion. And when I said to him, you know, Mr. President, I've just come from Berlin, he said to me, Tom, I remember the night the wall came down, you were the only one there. And I said, yes, I was. He said, I was in law school at the time. I thought, oh my God, he was in law school at the time. And that prompted me to think about how swiftly the trains of history pass by us, how they alter our lives and our expectations. Who would have thought, for example, in this audience, people my age and that generation, that at this stage, we would routinely deal with the end of the Soviet Empire when it had been such an ominous cloud over so much of our lives? Who would have thought, for example, I was just interviewed by a China scholar yesterday in Los Angeles about my early trips to China in the 1970s and the early 1980s. And he said, did you have any idea it would become what it did as swiftly as it did? And I said, it was the equivalent of going from the 10th century to the 21st century in one great leap. It just didn't seem possible. But all that did happen in the course of my lifetime. And then I began to think about my own life and what I leave behind. I began to think about my grandchildren, two in San Francisco and two in New York, and what kind of lives they may have. Will they be as fortunate as Meredith and I have been, or even their parents have been, to have not just the kind of quantitative life that we've had, the ability to earn a good income and have the things that we have and to travel the way that we have, but will they have the quality of life? Will they know economic justice in their own society? Will they know the satisfaction of society coming together to solve great problems, as we were witness to when Dr. Martin Luther King changed this nation forevermore with a nonviolent crusade against racial segregation? So that's what prompted me to write the book. But what also prompted me to think about these matters is that I spend a lot of time with the contemporary American military, both in this country and in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've been embedded in both those wars with special forces in the 10th Mountain Division. I've toured the northern part of Iraq with President Petraeus. Pardon me, with General Petraeus, he may be president one day. With General Petraeus, when he only had 2 stars, General Dempsey, who is now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, I remember the agonizing story that he told me when he was running the 1st Armored Division and I was in Iraq with him. And they had been extended because the war wasn't going well. They'd been extended after an 18-month tour for another 6 months. And he described to me going on the cargo plane that was going to take one of his battalions out of there and having to pull a young man off the plane because his tour had been extended and that young man was killed the next day. But none of us in this room knew him and didn't know his family because less than 1% of our population is in military uniform, doing all the fighting and taking all the wounds of war, coming home psychologically or physically damaged or too often in a body bag. And that's just inappropriate in a modern society, and especially in a democratic republic. It's unjust and it's immoral. So that's a place to begin. How do we knit ourselves back together? How do we find the connection between those who we ask to make the greatest sacrifices on our behalf and those of us who are left at home and nothing is required in our daily or long-term lives? We can put the work completely out of our mind. A lot of people have. No additional taxes. We don't have to think about the war if we don't have anyone involved. And most of this fighting is being done by working class kids and working class families who have a long tradition of military service. There's been almost no dialogue about that in this political year so far. In the election of 2010, the congressional election, no discussion whatsoever about the responsibility that we have to one another in terms of military sacrifice and service. I wrote an op-ed page piece about it for the New York Times saying, when it comes time to declare war, politicians go on the floor of the Congress or the Senate and talk about blood and treasure. When we have elections, we ignore the issue. That's inappropriate. So it seems to me that that's maybe a place to begin, as I write in the book, to think about how we can reach out to those families who are making these sacrifices, however you feel about the war. And I had great reservations about the need to go into Iraq when we did, what our objectives may have been in Iraq and especially in Afghanistan, how long we should stay. But nonetheless, that was the national policy. And young men and women in uniform are raising their hands, swearing their allegiance to the United States and making these sacrifices. At the same time, their families were at home. And what they were going through was best, for me, personified by a mother of a National Guardsman in Minneapolis. I was at a dinner up there for the Military Appreciation Fund, which they help with scholarships and short-term loans for returning veterans. And this woman got up and paid personal witness to what she'd been through. She was an executive at the Target Corporation. Very big job, and her son was in the National Guard and called and said, "Mom, I'm leaving tomorrow. My wife and she's expecting will be out there, but I think you should be there as well." And so Mom went, and she really kind of worked it into her calendar very quickly. And her life was transformed as she watched these young working class Minnesotans, most of whom didn't have college educations, getting on this plane in their combat gear as their sons and daughters were clinging to the leg of Daddy, not wanting him to go, and the young wives were kind of bewildered about how they would get along. And when the plane lifted off, the general came to this woman and said to her, "Mrs. Kuiper, your son has designated you as the chairperson of the families left at home." And her immediate reaction was, "I don't have time for this. I'm a busy executive." And she said, "Okay, what do I have to do?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to take you down to my office and give you a briefing about these families, who they are, and what some of their needs may be." She said, "By the end of that week, I learned what it was like to have someone serving in Iraq. When you go home, you pull the blind across the window that overlooks the driveway because you can't bear to see the military vehicle arriving with the chaplain." That for me is a haunting scene. And it's absolutely inappropriate for families to go through that in isolation without the rest of us reaching out to them in some fashion and saying, "How can I help? Can I do babysitting for you? Is there something, an errand I can do for you? What is it like for you? Is my service club doing enough? Or my church or temple? What kinds of needs do you have that I can help you with?" That's the smallest kind of connection. That prompted me to think about public service. Wherever I go, and some of this room may be thinking the same thing, should we bring back the draft? How come we don't have mandatory public service? If we want to pull the country back together again, don't we have to have some kind of common ground? The draft is not coming back. The military doesn't want it. They like the highly motivated volunteers who sign up at the recruiting offices. But it doesn't mean that we ought not to have something else. And so I write about what I think is a big, bold idea equivalent to the GI Bill at the end of World War II. My idea is that we have what I call the diplomatic special forces, Peace Corps Plus, you pick it. You put six public service academies across this country attached to land-grant schools. Berkeley's a land-grant school, or someplace like Davis, which has special skills. and you open it up, 3 year and 4 year programs, postgraduate and entry level, and you make it public-private. You have the Caterpillar Fellow in construction. You have the Johnson & Johnson Fellows in medicine, everything from postgraduate work or MD work or nurse practitioners or medical technicians. You have, for example, John Deere Fellows in agriculture, Donald Trump Fellows in hair design and styling. You decide what it is. You get 3 to 4 years of training, and then they're posted both domestically and abroad to put a different face on America. They do the work of winning hearts and minds and conflict resolution and helping the emerging nations of Africa with agriculture. And then at the end of 3 or 4 years, or whatever the term is, they come back to the home office of John Deere or Apple or the sponsoring company, and they've got 2 to 3 years to prove themselves as long-term employees of the company. It's a win-win. The companies get somebody who becomes a global citizen and understands how the world works with real skills. And the young people have an enormous amount of pride that they've served their nation in some time, in some fashion, but at the same time advance their own careers. We have too little of that. This coming Tuesday, I'll be in New York at a summit meeting by an organization in New York that I have encouraged to be kind of the epicenter of the efforts to do something about these military people who are coming back to be reintegrated into our societies. They've been warriors. They've been shooting, killing the bad people for 10 or 12 years. They're coming back to a complex economy. The job requirements are much different than when they left, and there aren't many of those jobs. So that, too, is a place to begin. And part of the reason that I want to raise the level of public service and the idea of it is that I think that we are in danger of raising a generation of young people now who feel disconnected from their country. There's so much political cynicism in America, and it plays out every day on the cable television and on the blogs and everywhere else. And these young people simultaneously are inclined to think that the world is really out there somewhere in cyberspace. If you push them hard enough, they may think that you can solve global poverty by hitting delete, or solve global warming by hitting backspace, that you can rearrange your life by cutting and pasting. A very prescient young man at Stanford, just a year ago, a senior at the law school when I was doing some work there, came up to me one day and he said, "You know, Mr. Brokaw, I know you've written a lot about generations. What about my generation and the meaning of the word friend? We now friend people. It's become a verb. Have we lost the true meaning, the character of having a friend and what that is essentially all about?" That too ought to be the part of the dialogue that we have. I like to say to these young people that it will do us little good to wire the world if we short-circuit our souls. We really need to think about the place of this exceptional, transformative technology in our lives. And there are so many lessons in it, in its research, its capacity for communication, its ability to, if you will, be a centerpiece of conflict resolution. But it can also be just a distraction. NBC has encouraged me to Twitter. I now have a Twitter account. I still don't understand what the hell it's all about. I've Twittered a couple of days ago during the 60th anniversary of the Today Show, something that got a lot of attention. So they said, "Could you Twitter during that experience?" When you're in the studio on the party the night before. Before I knew it, I had 25,000 people following my Twitter. And I kept thinking they were going to come to my house at some point. And I'm a kind of talkative person. 146 characters doesn't do it for me. I got to have a little more than that going on. So David Gregory is kind of one of my proteges in a way, and a good friend, our host of Meet the Press. He loves to Twitter. The other day, he Twittered that he was preparing for Sunday's Meet the Press and listening to Reba. And I said, "How thrilling, David, to know that." I think there is so much more that we're being told than we need to know. I think that we need to have a national dialogue about the meaning of all this. I have no doubt about the impact of social media, Facebook and Twitter and all the other accounts. There's no question about that. But have we stopped to talk about what the long-term effects of it are? What does it really mean? This is the first technology in which children are teaching their parents to drive. And parents ought to catch up to the idea that we ought to have a role in that. Certainly grandparents as well. I had an astonishing experience. When I turned 70, my San Francisco family came back to New York, and it was kind of a gathering of the tribe. And my San Francisco hipster granddaughters, I'm trying to always let them know that I'm, you know, I'm still with it a little bit. So I said, hey, let's go down and see the rehearsal of Saturday Night Live. They call me Tom, by the way, because they first saw me on television. It's a little unsettling to my friends when they walk and say, hey, Tom, I want to talk to you about something, instead of Grandpa or whatever. Anyhow, I took them down to Saturday Night Live at the rehearsal, and Ashton Kutcher was the host at the time. And as soon as we sat down, Clara, the eldest, was texting. I said, what are you doing? She said, Tom, this is a monumental moment. I'm texting all my friends. I'm seeing Ashton Kutcher. So dress rehearsal ends. One of my friends on Saturday Night Live said, hey, Ashton Kutcher would like to come over and say hello. And I said, fine, I'd never met him. He came over, and we come from the same part of the country, and we talked a little bit, and I introduced him to Claire and Meredith, and he said to the girls, well, why are you here? And they said, well, it's Tom's 70th birthday. And he said, my God, I don't believe it. You don't look 70. And I thought, I'm beginning to like Ashton a lot more right away. And I said, well, I'm afraid that's the case, and so on. And so we get in the car, the girls and I get in the car, we're driving back, and all of a sudden, our PDAs, the Blackberries and their iPhones, just light up, because he has a big Twitter account. And he's talked about this meeting. And I thought, you know, maybe there's more to this guy than I realize. And it went on like that, in terms of how I relate to my granddaughters and to the younger people. But what I'm trying to do is turn the dial a little bit to get them to think about this question that that young man asked me at Stanford. What is the meaning of friends? What is the real use of this technology? Because I think that's the test of our time. The use of that technology, our place as citizens, how much we relate to one another, whatever our particular ideologies or political interests are on a contemporary basis over a long term, how we knit ourselves back together again. The genius of this immigrant nation has always been, when the challenges were the greatest, we were more than the sum of our parts. At the moment, I think everyone agrees that we're not more than the sum of our parts. That we've allowed ourselves to be so deeply divided and polarized, in part by this new technology and blogospheres and the ability of people to unleash a jihad, if you will, electronically against others, without someone stopping and saying, wait a minute, this is destructive and not constructive. We have astonishing challenges before us. The rise of China is a perfect example. There is a story in the New York Times just today about Apple, which took great pride in making its iPhone in this country until it was no longer possible to do that economically. But China had factories and workers who were equipped to make the iPhone and make rapid changes technologically when the United States was not. There is not enough discussion about that. If you go to America and come through JFK, the airport, I would think as an immigrant you'd be inclined to get on the next airplane and go home. If you go to Beijing and land at that airport, you say, this is not the 21st century, it's the 22nd century. Doesn't mean that China doesn't have problems. They've got enormous problems, beginning with what they don't know. There is so much that they don't know about the challenges that are ahead of them. They are now at a place where they have more people living in cities than they do in the countryside. They have more than 100 cities with more than 1 million people in population. All those people want utilities and appliances and cars and jobs. That's going to be a very tough order to fill, especially when you try to keep the controls politically on that population as well. As we're gathered here tonight, I can promise you there are young Chinese who are hacking into the system or looking at something that the government has forbade. So they've got real challenges ahead of them. But we're not going to stay even with them just by going on autopilot. Because 100 years from now, historians are going to look back on our time and make a judgment not just about the Tea Party, or about President Obama, or Newt Gingrich winning South Carolina, or however the election turns out this fall. They're going to make a determination about all of us. They're going to say, what did the American population do when these challenges rose up to meet them? Did they respond? Did they step forward into the arena and re-enlist as citizens? I think that's the test. And if we do that, I think it can energize this country, and we can have enormous pride in what we've accomplished together, because that, again, has always been unique in the American dream. What has been most troubling to me is I have traveled the country in the last 3 years, and this happens to me wherever I am, whatever ideological or theological or cultural corner of America, people come up to me and say, Mr. Brokaw, I am worried that my children will not have the lives that I've had. I never heard that before. And I say to them, the only way we can change that is by stepping forward and demanding to be heard. And not shouting, but listening more. Finally, I'll leave you before I take questions with another anecdote, I think, that kind of sums up how I feel about all this. And that is, involves my two San Francisco granddaughters. My wife and I are both very active outdoors people. We couldn't wait for them to get to an age where we could take them into the wilderness in Montana. We may have rushed it a little bit. They were 8 and 6 when they came to Montana 1 year, and we announced to them we were going on an overnight camping trip, going to a backcountry, tiny cabin that the cowboys used during roundup time. And it would be a hike through deep woods and high grass without trails, but we knew the way. You could tell they were a little wary about the whole thing. But they pushed on, a little kvetching about the bugs and the hard, long hike. But when we got there, you know, we were cooking outside and they were seeing game, elk in the distance, and even a bear. And then Meredith, who they call Nan, explained that they would sleep in the cabin. It's a really tiny cabin, just kind of room for 2 people. In their sleeping bags with their little headlamps. And she explained to them that Tom and I will be just outside. And so we were. And when it gets dark in Montana, it really gets dark in the wilderness. So they got tucked in and we went out and got into our sleeping bags. And as soon as we got into our sleeping bags, we could hear the buzz from in the cabin. And suddenly the tiny feet hit the floor. And the youngest of the two comes charging out of the cabin in the dark, on the porch, leans over our 2 sleeping bags and says in a very commanding voice, Nan, we need an adult in here now. I'm persuaded that's what the country is. We need an adult in here now. We're all adults and we should take our role. Thank you very much.
During signing, would you like me to say no personal reason?
No, if it's just the first name, that's okay.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, I have a bunch of questions and I think there are more coming. The first one's a pretty tough one. This person says, Iran's nuclear goals to publicly have nuclear power and secretly to have nuclear weapons. And actually, I have 2 questions, so I'm going to combine them. These people are asking, what do we do about that? And are we secretly doing some things that would really be declaring war?
Well, I don't think we're, it's a huge conundrum, it's a huge dilemma. There's a lot of talk that is going on, obviously, behind the scenes, and
We're in close contact, both officially and unofficially, with Israel. We're putting lots of efforts into the Russian piece of it. They have better relations with Iran than we do. The economic sanctions are taking a bite at the moment. There's some indication of that. But what does that lead to? We're not sure. Are they so defiant in that theocracy that they then go to the mattresses and greater determination to build a bomb? Here's the other part of the dilemma for us. Pakistan has about 100 nuclear weapons, we think, at this point. And that country is, in many ways, as unstable as Iran. So I think the greater effort ought to be simultaneously, and that there is underway, to ban all nuclear weapons. That includes the United States. And that would be a great legacy for this president, President Putin, and the other Russian leaders. It is highly unlikely to happen. But they ought to begin that dialogue at the summit, the Chinese, the Americans, the great nuclear powers in the world, to say, why do we have nuclear weapons? Because they pose such an enormous threat to mankind as we know it. Who's to say who has control of the weapons, for example, in Pakistan? And we know that India has a nuclear weapon and capability. China has a nuclear weapon and capability as well. We know that the North Koreans have a nuclear weapon. So it's not just about Iran, but Iran obviously is on the table at the moment, in part because of Islamic rage, which has something to do with that, and their attitudes about what they want to do about the West. So there are efforts underway. Economic and diplomatic sanctions are the first big step. We'll see how they play out and what the effect of it happens to be. But it's not just unilaterally the United States or the United States and Israel together. That's not going to work. We're going to need more help from the French, from the Germans, and especially from the Russians and the Chinese to get this done. And no one has an easy answer because there is not one.
I have a question about super PACs. Given Citizens United and the unlimited amount of money that people can spend, we know that if we think we've been inundated, we've only just begun. People are asking, where do we go for real information, and how do we step up and do anything to?
Well, you're not going to get rid of super tax because PACs at the moment, in part because of the Citizens United decision of the U.S. Supreme Court saying that corporations and people who have interest have unlimited ability to spend money on behalf of them. As the court saw it, it is a form of free speech. I am, if not a free speech absolutist, very close to it. I believe that people ought to have an ability to express themselves, and money has been a way of doing that in politics for far too long. When I was in California that long ago, I used to go do stories about who was giving money and how much they were giving, and you can't believe the filing in those days. I'd go up to the Secretary of State's office, and the filing requirements were that you could put names on a piece of paper with no space between them and no space between the lines. So it was almost impossible to figure out who was giving how much. A big step for me in super PACs would be transparency. As soon as they're formed, we ought to be able to go online and see who is giving the money and how much they're giving. That's one way of dealing with it. Part of the problem we've always had is that there's never been much of a groundswell of outrage about this because most people just think it's the way it's always been done in politics. But next year, this is a moral outrage. We're going to spend more than $2 billion on the presidential campaign when we have so many other needs in this country. So rise up and say to people who ask you for money, I'm not going to give you money. Or I want to know where that money is coming from. And as a consumer of political ads and information and robocalls that come to you, you have to be extra alert these days to determine where the information is coming from, what the motives are, and what the objectives are.
Thank you. You spoke briefly about education, and one of the things I personally love in your book is how you set out an issue and then you talk to real people about it. But I have a question here from someone who would like you to talk a little bit more about education. And then I have another question from someone who wants to know about specifically to California and what Governor Brown might specifically do.
Okay. Well, I really believe in all my heart that education is the currency of the 21st century. We cannot compete with the obvious competition that we have in China and Brazil and India and Russia without educating everybody. Part of the reason that Apple went to China to manufacture its iPhones is that they had a more educated workforce than we do. We have a workforce that doesn't have the skill set. Like 20% of our high school graduates, when they go to a four-year college, have to take remedial math and reading courses. There's an explosion of community colleges across the country because A, they're good bargains, and B, they teach young people the skill set that manufacturers in America need. We have very strong manufacturing base in this country, high tech. That's still going on. They're turning out turbine blades, for example, for wind turbines for energy, and they're doing carbon composite fuselages for jets. But you talk to any of those manufacturers and they say, I can't get young people who have the skill set, who have the reasoning. We've been able to train a workforce that we inherited, but we need to have a place where they can go get the skills that they need. Then the big turn is, two big turns. One is, in the general population, we have to have much more science that is required. In China, you have to take math, physics, and biology as an eighth grader. In America, only 18% of our high school students take those courses. Now stop and think about what are going to be the courses that are going to help determine our ability to navigate the technological future. Obviously, those courses. At the same time in this country, we are educating primarily the kind of white suburban class. The inner cities have been ignored far too long. You can't go forward as a nation if you educate only one piece of your population. What is encouraging to me, it's now on the agenda. In New York, for example, when Mike Bloomberg became the mayor, the first thing he did was take control of the schools, and we've made real progress. And I like the mixed menu of charter schools and school choice and public schools that are closed down if they don't perform, and public schools that then have a specific reason for being, a technological school of some kind, or even a vocational school of some kind. But it all has to be on the agenda. Now, Governor Brown, having talked to him the other day, one of the reasons that he's doing what he's doing is he's trying to save California education. And that's why he's asked for the tax increase on the wealthy in California and for an additional half cent in sales tax so that he doesn't have to take the money out of the education system. Here's just a perfect, the university system in California has been a great engine in driving this state. There's just no question about it. Both the state college and the university system has been the engineers that you've turned out and the accountants and the teachers and the educators of all kinds and the physicians. I think I've got the numbers right. In 1995, UC Berkeley and Stanford professors were at parity. By 2000, there was a 10% differentiation in their salary. I think now it's like 15%. Well, you're not going to keep the great UC professors with that kind of differentiation. And so what you have to do is to make sure that education remains the underpinning of the state. And that's a tough call. And it's not just about money. It's about school consolidation and about requirements, and it's about community involvement. I've said about my generation as the beneficiary of a great public education and the opportunities that came with it when I was coming out of high school and college in 58 and 62, the way we can give back is to go to public schools and help tutor or help them with their needs. I help a specific school in the South Bronx of New York. This principal made a cold call on me. She said, I know you're interested in education. I have a real issue here. I went up to see her in the middle of a Hispanic neighborhood. 90% of the parents were single parents. The other 10% of the population was West African emigres who had just come here. The school plant was actually in good shape. It was built in 1956, 57, so it was one of those wonderful old schools with strong foundations and tile floors. And she took me to the second floor. There's a completely empty room, about half the size of this room. I said, what's this? She said, well, it was a library. We don't have any books. We don't have access to anything. I want to make this into a community center, a learning center for the parents as well as for the kids. The teachers have agreed to stay until 7 o'clock at night to help everybody out, but I need to raise some money. So I was one of the fundraisers and worked with her, and we put together a pretty good chunk of dough. It's now completely wired with computers, electronic books, and traditional print books, and it's open until 7 o'clock at night. This one principal was able to do that on her own by marshaling her young teachers and saying, I'm going to ask you to volunteer to do this, and then going out into the community and raising the money. And that story has been repeated a lot around the country. A lot of companies have gone in and adopted schools, but it takes initiative. We just can't sit back and say it's going to happen to us.
The next question is about Washington and politicians being wrapped around the finger of certain corporate interests, and it relates to another question we have here. What do you think about the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Well, first of all, Washington is not just wrapped around corporate interests. It's wrapped around every kind of interest that has access to an internet, because they can organize themselves way out of proportion to their numbers. If somebody doesn't vote the very narrow interest that a special interest group has, they target that person, and they unleash this barrage of criticism and threats against them. And so every congressman that I know, and by the way, this happens in the public, municipal level and the state level as well, they've got full-time staff members just looking at what's being said about them, because they're all terrified about not getting reelected. So way out of proportion to their numbers, these individual groups that don't look at the kind of wider interests of the country but want to measure everybody just by their very narrow, well-defined issue, whether it's guns or abortion or the environment or whatever it happens to be. And that has a paralyzing effect and a polarizing effect on this country simultaneously. Occupy Wall Street. It's kind of been a pudding without a theme, and I'm not quite sure what it stands for. We've had a lot of people camped out, but it was absent leadership, frankly, about what they wanted to do and where they wanted to get there. There are enough people in this room. If you want to talk about a movement that had an enormous historic impact in this country, the Dr. King model was the perfect example of that. Moral persuasion, power of oratory, belief in the rule of law, and an appeal to the conscience of the country about what was wrong. And constantly reinforcing that with a philosophy of nonviolence. I've been at most of these Occupy Wall Street movements around the nation, in Chicago and New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, and they're very, very ill-formed, and they've pretty much disappeared from the landscape. If you want to talk about a movement, this won't make a lot of people in this room happy. If you want to talk about a movement that has had impact, it's the Tea Party. And the Tea Party has had impact because they got angry, then they got organized, then they went to Washington, and they've stayed on message. It's way too narrowly cast. There's no question about that. But they have real passion about what they do, and they have discipline, and they're in touch with each other, and they stay within what they believe their interests are. That's what I say to a lot of people who come to me and complain about the Tea Party. I say, well, the only way you can deal with them is to play by the rules, out organize them. It takes a lot of work. And I've talked to a lot of these Tea Party members, and most of them were completely apolitical until about 5 years ago. There was a woman in South Carolina last week who was a very active member of the Tea Party there. She said, I was an online editor and I was an animal welfare activist until the Tea Party came along, and it expressed so many of my frustrations. Now she spends half of her day on Tea Party Matters. So those are the realities, and sometimes it's hard to accept, but that's what's going on.
I have a couple questions about immigration, including one from someone who arrived in 1959, when this person says it was a good time to come here as an immigrant. I know that in your book you talk about that some. Can you talk a little bit about where we can go with immigration, since it seems to be so polarizing?
Yeah, the immigration thing puzzles me in a lot of ways. I mean, the state is a perfect example. You would come to a halt without immigration, legal and illegal, right? I mean, think about the jobs that are done by the illegal immigrants in California. Same thing is true along most of the border states. I think a lot of it has to do with people who are afraid of losing their predominance in the culture, that it becomes more of a Hispanic culture than an Anglo culture. There's a lot of that that goes on. And a country, a sovereign country, should have control of its borders. The fact is that this is an illegal act to come here across those borders without a visa and work off the books, so to speak, even though a lot of these illegal immigrants are paying sales taxes and they're paying other kinds of taxes. The fact is that they're out there in between the layers of America. But the country would come to a halt without them. I've done documentaries on them, and you go to Colorado and in the construction trades or in the service trades, certainly in the hotel service trades, and almost all the workers are immigrants, and how many of them are illegal, I don't know. But I think we have to have the kind of conversation that doesn't get hysterical the moment somebody opens their mouth about it. A perfect example is that whatever else you think about Newt Gingrich, and I don't think I want to poll the room about that right now. Newt Gingrich said early on in his presidential run, if you've been here for 10, 12 years and you've had children born here, I think you ought to have a path to citizenship. It's a completely reasonable idea, it seemed to me. There are a lot of things that Newt says and does that I can't track at all. But that one, I thought, you know, he's on to something. He got killed by the Republican Party. And he very quickly backed away from it. It's a huge issue in this country, and we're going to have to deal with it. One of the things that we do ignore is a failed state in our southern borders, and that's Mexico, and it's very close to that. For all the efforts that we make in other parts of the world, we ought to be making sure that Mexico has a political stability and the kind of economy that will keep people at home. That ought to be a very high priority for us. It's a tragedy what is happening in Mexico. You have generation after generation now being born and being raised in a culture of violence. They have no regard for rule of law whatsoever. It's a matter of just utter terrorism there. And it breaks my heart when I go down to the border either on this side or on the other side.
Our last question is going to be asked by the president of Dominican, Dr. Mary Marcy.
I think this is the first time I've asserted presidential privilege to ask a question, but something you said was so on point with something that's happening at the university, I'd like you to expand a bit. You talked about public service, and one of the things that we're just starting to require our undergraduates to do is to have at least three experiences of active learning, primarily service-oriented, beyond the classroom before they graduate. So service learning, internships, undergraduate research, leadership development. And I'd like to talk, I'm thinking now we should call them Brokaw Fellows, actually. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the ideas that you have for a diplomatic corps and public service.
Well, what's interesting to me is that there is a lot of work like this that's going on around the country, but it's too much off the radar or below the radar, that we ought to find ways of rewarding that kind of work beyond the university, beyond this campus. The society should honor that work. I mean, Tim Russert's widow, Marina Orth, was an early Peace Corps volunteer. By the way, she grew up in Northern California. She didn't go to school here, but her mother might have gone here to Dominican. I'm not sure, by the way. At any rate, you know, it's very frustrating to Marine because she knows the kind of great work that she was able to do as a Peace Corps volunteer. Chris Matthews, who's been here, was a Peace Corps volunteer. She does, Marine goes back down to Colombia. But it's not on the radar in a way. We don't honor it. I've often said that if we really wanted to draw attention to this, we would say, join the Peace Corps and meet Lindsay Lohan. Because she seems to get most of the attention in the generation. The fact is that every community should be talking about public service and honoring it. So it's not just enough that they go out and do it, or that they get honored within their campus, but they ought to get honored within their community as well. There are a lot of programs across America. I've been honored by something called the Horatio Alger Society. This is a group of men who have done very well, starting with nothing. They're very conservative politically, but they have a, a program for young people in which they honor their efforts and try to help them get to where they need to get to, and public service is a component of that. In New York, there's something called the Robin Hood Foundation. I don't know how many of you are aware of that, but a lot of people are pulled into that. A guy by the name of Jeffrey Canada has something called the Harlem Children's Zone in the inner city, where a lot of young people work. But we need to raise, it seems to me, the level of recognition that they get. Honor them with letter jackets and gifts of whatever kind you can. Maybe it's as simple as what Warren Buffett does with teachers in Omaha. Omaha has an unusual school system. The oligarchy of Omaha, which is fairly well defined but very wealthy, decided some time ago that they would not send their kids to private schools, they would send them to the public school system. So they helped rearrange the public school system so Omaha Central, which is where Warren's family was educated and my wife taught at one point, really is the humanities school. And then there's Benson, I think that's at this point science primarily, and in junior high you apply to these high schools within Omaha to try to get in depending on what your interests are. And then at the end of every year they have a big banquet, and Warren goes to the banquet and he hands out to something like 20 teachers, the most outstanding teachers in Omaha, checks for $35,000, I think it is now. And he says to him, you go to Las Vegas, I don't care what you do with it, but you've earned this by being a good. Well, you know what that's done for the city of Omaha? Everybody is interested in education because they think, A, the teachers think there's a payoff for me in doing well, someone will recognize me. And the kids then become very competitive about where they want to go and how they want to get there. And public service is a component of all the schools. But mostly, I believe, it's raise the level of recognition. And so what you do at Dominican ought not to stay in Dominican. It ought to be part of the greater San Rafael area or Northern California. Dominican ought to partner with other schools and say, how do we become larger than the sum of our parts when it comes to public service? So we have a bigger bang and pick out, for example, take all the colleges in Northern California and say, this is the project that we're going to work on next year and let's get together on it. I think that's one of the ways that you can do it. People are eager to do it. Young people, especially now, because there are no jobs. I mean, the Teach for America is overrun with applications, quite honestly, and most of these other programs are as well because they can't get other jobs.
Thank you for that. We are going to close in a minute. I do again want to thank Private Ocean for sponsoring our series and Circle Bank for helping us bring Mr. Brokaw to you tonight. And we will be getting your book signed. And there happen to be booksellers over there in the corner who can sell you even more books, including some of Tom Brokaw's earlier books. Mr. Brokaw has graciously agreed to put a name in the book, but please don't ask him to say, I'll never forget, you know, last week or anything like that. And I don't know who won the game, but you don't want to know, don't ask. Tom Brokaw, thank you for a fabulous book and a wonderful evening.
The Institute for Leadership Studies Worldwide with Tom Brokaw, starting off the spring 2012 season on radio.dominican.edu. Thank you for listening.